I can talk to my baby when I'm driving all alone.
Sirius XM's E Street Radio's Springsteen Community Conference. Every month, we're seating different Bruce experts to discuss a Springsteen topic from past, present, and future. This month, Ben Lazar, John Frank, Flynn McLean, Stu Wexelbaum, Jovan Mervos, and Louis Largent discuss Bruce Springsteen, Man at the Top, focusing on the 25th anniversary of the Born in the USA tour.
E Street Radio, this is the Springsteen Community Conference. I'm Ben Lazar from A Deeper Shade of Soul. Today we're doing a great panel discussion on the 25th anniversary of the Born in the USA tour, the album, the phenomenon, and the explosion in Bruce's popularity that happened a quarter century ago. We have a tremendous panel of Bruce fans here today, starting with Jovan Mervos, former A&R man at Columbia Records, Patty Scalfa's A&R person, late 80s, music director of WXRT in Chicago, and a veteran of many Springsteen shows before and after the Born in the USA tour, who has seen the Springsteen saga unfold from the beginning.
Right on.
We have Flynn McLean, a regular contributor and columnist to Backstreets Magazine, one of the most knowledgeable Springsteen fans on earth, I would even dare to say. We have Stu Wexelbaum, owner of Stu's Records in the East Village in New York, a Springsteen collector and fan who has seen some very legendary shows in the past.
I'm here.
Excellent. My good friend Louis Largent.
I'm the most experienced guy here in terms of multimedia, but the least experienced in terms of Springsteen knowledge.
Well, Louis is one of the most passionate music fans I know and a big Bruce fan. He was program director at KROQ in Los Angeles, VJ on MTV, and I work with him at Island Def Jam Records in the early aughts, doing A&R with him.
Yep.
And my co-moderator, my good friend John Frank, music marketer extraordinaire, who's going to be starting us off on the panel today.
All right, so let's delve right in. So in the spring of 1984, Bruce is gearing up for the release of the Born in the USA album and tour. Where would you say it was in terms of his career and his popularity? Mervos.
Well, I think you have to look at what, you know, what happened prior to this. And what we have is like, and you check me out here, we have The River, right?
But we had Nebraska right before Born in the USA.
We had Nebraska, right, which was a departure from The River. The River, a two-record set that really, I think, solidified what you had coming off of Born to Run. But it really, from my point of view, it really solidified him at what was then probably one of the most dominant radio formats, AOR, album-oriented radio. And I think The River took him out of venues like the Auditorium Theater in Chicago, the Uptown Theater, and threw him into the Rosemont. So you're going from 4,000, 5,000 max at the theaters into 18,000-seat almost indoor sports arenas.
And it happened over the course of that River tour.
Exactly, exactly, because I think the early dates started at the 4,000 or 5,000-seat, and then
Were we living in the same town? It was like four sports arenas the first go-around.
Well, you know, this was the typical thing. On the coasts, on the East Coast, on the West Coast, Bruce was already playing arenas. He'd been playing arenas on the Darkness tour, but in the middle of the country,
You didn't have that kind of a footprint already at radio.
Secondary and tertiary markets were still evolving for him.
In Chicago, you would consider at that level almost a secondary market outside of the universities, you know, given having played at, McGraw-Hall in Evanston. He'd done the...
Is that 78?
Yeah, it was 78, 79. He had done the uni tours, right? He had done a lot of the...
The Darkness tour hit a lot of colleges.
A lot of colleges, and so he laid it down. But, I mean, in terms of the jump, I thought that was huge was from the intimacy. And there was intimacy at the 4,000-seat level. I mean, it was the Church of Rock and Roll. It was Bruce and the band doing pretty much a soul revival show. A lot of covers. A lot of extended monologues.
They were very much of a show band.
Very much of a show band. And then what you saw was these stadium shows. You saw Ben and I were jiving about it. It was essentially, you know, Bruce on steroids.
But he was like the biggest cult guy, though. You could almost say that because he wasn't video friendly yet. He had only done Atlantic City, and they were playing that Rosalita live video all the
from
time
Muse,
for
right.
lieu of anything else. So he was still gigantic, but he hadn't hit that sort of Michael Jackson, Duran Duran stage, which were the big sort of things going on at that moment.
It was really clear
it was very clear, you know, when I saw him at the Nassau Coliseum on the River Tour, that the ante had gone up. You know, it was no longer the 4,000 or 5,000 seaters. They weren't going to happen anymore. He has gone to the next level. And what's interesting to me about that aspect of it is that the previous album, which was Nebraska, which was a total departure from everything he had delivered before or recorded since, in my opinion, that album really spoke to a lot of people that really weren't essential Bruce fans. It was a different kind of album. I remember my boss, you know, who owned a record store in Queens, came to me and said, you know, I got this album, and I don't really like it that much. And I don't, and he's coming from the perspective, I'm not going to sell a lot of these albums. I got to hear it, and I said to him, you know, I don't feel that way. To me, this album is a novel. He's writing a novel here, and he's singing a novel.
A deep record.
And from that gave him the freedom for Born in the USA and that explosion that took place, because it was he delivered on Born in the USA, because I think he had to, you know, in terms of the marketplace. He had to, and he did deliver.
Well, going back to what Jovan said, is that in 1981, in the summer of 81, he did what basically constituted a victory lap of his major markets, and they were all arenas. So as we were saying earlier, he goes from the theaters of the early part of the River Tour to playing, what, 6 sold-out shows at an L.A. Sports Arena.
Yeah.
You know, he did 5 at the Meadowlands. And, you know, to me, he was right after that album, he was on that cusp of exploding. And I mean, if you take out Nebraska, it really
it was there.
It was inevitable.
Right.
At that point, as long as he had some good songs to release, you know, with the next record, he was going to explode. And I don't think there was anything anybody could have done about it. You know, talk about Nebraska. Yeah, it was an exception, and I think it brought in some new listeners, and it also enabled him to really pump up the shows on that tour.
And it's an important thing to know that when they decided to release Nebraska, they had Born in the USA in the can.
Yeah.
They had Born in the USA. They had Glory Days done. They had Down Bound Train.
Pink Cadillac.
They had Pink Cadillac. No, but I think Pink Cadillac was recorded in 83.
But it was a part of
the... But it was definitely part of the Nebraska thing, but they had Working on the Highway. They had half the album done.
Yes, and I think wasn't it part of the deal with the record company to say, Bruce wants to release this solo acoustic album he did in his bedroom, like New Year's Eve weekend. But the next one's going to be a huge album. It's going to be the big rock album that they want.
I think he could have done anything he wanted from a record company standpoint after Born to Run, and I think that they had primed the pump, so to speak.
Because was all this anticipation sort of self-inflicted on, you know?
Well,
on
no,
their
I think they, had a sense of what they had with the River. I think that set them up. They knew what they had. And I think that working off of, again, I always use this arc, this narrative arc that he's creating as a writer.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a flexing that comes to fruition in Born in the USA. I think there he's starting to say, and this is pure bullshit speculation on my part that has no basis in reality and it's just, you know, tripping here. But my sense is that there's this sense of writing power.
Confidence.
Confidence that says, you know what, I can do this top 40 stuff. I can get stuff that's going to impact pop radio.
There's an important distinction. He wanted it. One of the biggest, he expressed it in 78. He was disappointed that Badlands didn't do as well as a single. He was disappointed that Born to Run only got to 23 on the charts. Bruce grew up in an era of hits, and he wanted hit records.
Yeah. He wanted a bunch of hungry hearts.
He got it.
And he got it.
And he got it.
He got it. He got it big time. Yeah. You know, 7 top 10 singles, right?
So the first single that dropped in May was Dancing in the Dark. Very much a departure in a lot of ways. Very synthesizer heavy, which really began, you know, Born in the USA really was Bruce's first extensive use of synths.
You know, it's really important, too, because Europe was primed for Bruce in Normandy, too, because, you know, on the River Tour, he was playing huge arenas in Europe. He was playing multi-nights at Wembley Arena in London, and they were ready, too. They were ready for something huge.
Finally, London is ready for Bruce Springsteen.
Finally.
Absolutely.
I shared the story with Lewis in 1978. I was living in London. I had left 77, 78. I had taken
the Forrest Gump of rock and roll. Right.
I had taken Born to Run with me, and on a cassette. because that's what it was. And I played it for some friends of mine in London, and they just trashed it. That on the Elvis Costello thing, Bruce took Elvis to task for the comments that were made, which I was reminded were prevalent at the time in the UK. With the exception,
too romantic was the quote, right?
Yes, right, exactly.
Too romantic, Elvis.
With the exception of up north, where they were much more inclined to be
Manchester,
Leeds,
Stolt Man,
Northern Soul. Yeah. So they got the essence of what he was about.
Oh wow!
But in London, they just thought it was rubbish.
But you know what the 1978 best record from the writers of NME was? Darkness on the Edge of Town. It was the album of the year. 78.
Is that right?
Yep. And yet he didn't play London or Europe that year.
He didn't play Europe on the Darkness Tour.
Sorry to interrupt Ben, but, you know, Bruce Springsteen was considered a hard rock act in a lot of places in Europe. People don't know that, but he would make the end of year polls in hard rock magazines, little known fact.
Right up there with Motorhead.
Absolutely. One of the greatest live bands of all time.
Lemmy.
Yeah, without a doubt.
So here we are, you know, we're going into 1984. With Born in the USA, and, you know, I'm in a record store in Queens, and people are lining up outside the door to get in to buy this album the day it came out. That wasn't the experience with Nebraska.
Right.
You know, it was a different experience. And one thing that I started to realize at that time, that this is a serious artist. This is not some flash in the pan here. Here's a man who put out Born to Run and had to wait 3 years to put out Darkness on the Edge of Town. Then puts out a double album called The River, and then puts out Nebraska.
Right.
And then he has this big explosion. It was like a momentum, like you said earlier, nothing was going to stop it. It was going to happen. And Born in the USA was the apex in that moment of his career.
It's the perfect storm between radio and retail.
Absolutely.
Because that's when it really, then you see the impact because of the saturation play at radio. Lewis, you were K-Rock. I was at WXRT. I was the music director. That record, when it was released, went into the bin, and every track was played on it. And I would think in a matter of weeks, I mean, The Loop and the other AOR corp, you know.
Yeah, and, you know, it's also, you know, you look at the cover, right? He's got his jeans on and his butt showing. And he's like, he's giving a message. You know, I took it, you know, I'm looking at, like, you know, Born in the USA, well, kiss my ass. I've got things I want to say about what's going on in this country.
That's an interesting take on it. I've never heard that one before.
You know, and he really, I felt, you know, when he's talking about Born in the USA, the thing that haunted me about the album, you know, the song Born in the USA, you know, when he talks about his brother going off to war, you know, they're still there, he's all gone. You know, I had a brother who served, and, you know, he came home alive, but from another perspective, he was gone. He wasn't the same person who had left. So on that level, it hit me very personally. And, you know, you take the beginning of the album and the last cut, My Hometown, there's the Americana experience up to that point in that whole album. Whether you're working on a highway, whether you're working in a car wash, he was hitting on all of it. And I think that's what the American people in the audience and how it grew out globally really came right at that moment. It was the perfect timing. And look at his physique at the time.
Well, I mean,
Nautilus.
Yeah, I mean, it was like all of a sudden the guy is, you know, like
pumped up.
He blew up
literally.
Yeah.
It was incredible.
No, I think Stu hits on something here, and that is that, you know, again, stepping back as I am wont to do and looking at it as a writer, you know, from a purely literary standpoint, that he's taken this experience, and you and I were talking about this, the intimacy. And that intimacy that he created in those venues was the ability that he had to make you feel special as he reached out and touched you in that rock and roll church that he created. I think that what he did, though, in Born in the USA was from the narrative, as you so well indicated, he was able to touch people he had that incisive ability to connect with people and create that intimacy on a massive grand scale.
Yeah.
I mean, to the point where you're in Giant Stadium with, 60,000 people that are feeling like ultra connected to this guy.
And he certainly, I mean, that was one of the challenges when he went to stadiums the next summer, was how can he make Giant Stadium feel like the bottom line?
Yeah.
And, you know, he supersized everything. Now, and some people may argue that was a bad thing, and some may say it was a good thing to reach everybody, but it's what happened.
But I think he was able to succeed because the narrative did it. Because the lyrics, the power of the lyrics, and the power to touch people on a one-to-one basis, I think he's constantly increasing it.
Lewis, what did you think about the album when you first heard it?
I loved it. Yeah. I mean, what is there not to? I'm the everyman fan. I guess we all were at the time. It's not like we were the music business experts that we are now. I was working at a golf course and listening to KMET and was so excited for that record to come out and. I loved every track and listened to it all the time. You know, I loved its popness. I loved its sheen. I loved its
effortlessness.
I loved its pop sensibility. I loved its well-craftedness. It was the first Pyromania, you know, or Adrenalize or something. You know, it was his Def Leppard album before Def Leppard was who they
Absolutely.
Were.
Absolutely.
This seems like a perfect time to get into some music. We're going to be playing a live version of Dancing in the Dark from November 19th, 1984 at the Kemper Arena.
Higher, even if Everybody, it's John Frank back on E Street Radio. And we're going to delve into an interesting topic now, which is the change in the band's lineup. The E Street Band had been a pretty solid band for a number of years. A few members came and went, but there was definitely a very important change around the Born in USA era. Little Steven took off for a solo career and was replaced by Nils Lofgren of Grin and Neil Young fame. And also there was the addition of the Miss Patty Scalfa, who introduced a whole different element of sound to the band. And I wanted to get Flynn's feedback on that. So Flynn from Backstreets.
Well, I think overall there was a huge shift in the sound, regardless of the band members. For the first time, Bruce brought a synthesizer on the road with him. Obviously, they always had an organ, and I guess they went to the Farfisa, with the cheesy, almost carnival-like sound. They used that in the past, but this was the first time they actually brought a synthesizer along with them. And it wasn't used on the past songs, but it was so heavy on the record and on the new songs that it was so obvious.
They add that to all the other songs on the tour? Born in the USA songs?
It was just the Born in the USA songs. Now, there was also, they used it as an intro to Racing in the Street. Because that was not an organ. That was definitely a synthesizer, not an organ.
And they used it on the Nebraska songs that Bruce rearranged.
Right.
Mm. Very much so, yeah.
And then, of course, obviously the personnel changes. You had Patty coming in. Presumably her role was to hit the high notes that Steve used to hit. And where Steve was kind of, he was there in the background vocals on a lot of ways, but he wasn't in your face. Whereas I think Patty really brought it out, especially out in the street and Trapped. When she was there, when she was hitting those notes, everybody knew it. There was no subtlety to her backing vocals, and that's obviously what Bruce wanted. And then you got Nils replacing Steven, or at least taking his position on the stage. And whereas Steve was a straight ahead rock guitarist, Nils brought some finesse and that Steve didn't have, and I think that really added a lot to the Nebraska material. When they were doing the pseudo solo acoustic stuff like Johnny 99, Nebraska, Reason to Believe, that was stuff I'm not sure Steve could have done. He could have done it, but with Nils it was a lot more natural.
Right, it had a different texture to it.
Exactly.
Less gritty.
Yes.
And Nils talked about it in terms of, he was, when this tour started, he was playing the straight parts, adding a finger pick here and a finger pick there. But, pretty soon he was pretty much finger picking everywhere.
Did you feel there was a difference in tone, too, between Nils and Steven coming from the mix? Could you hear that on that tour?
I cannot answer.
I think there definitely was a definite change in tone. Nils' guitar tone is so much different from Little Steven's.
Well, different guitars.
Yeah, Steven's got that Keith Richards kind of heritage, and Nils had a totally different kind of sound. I think it made a huge, that combined with Roy's more increased emphasis on synthesizers, it modernized the sound to a much greater extent than it had on any tour previously. And I think it was a huge difference, and I think it brought a versatility to the band, especially, as we were talking about before, that really came out in the Nebraska material, which they rearranged live.
It was also, Nils live, seeing him on stage, he added a new element. He did these flips, he was running, he was happy, he was joyful, he was so glad to be there. And that just fed the audience and fed the show.
And he also wore the giant hat.
Yes, he did. during Cadillac Ranch. That's right. Good. Thank you, Lewis.
You're welcome.
Very true. I want to touch on something else, too, because the overall sound of the band very much changed, especially as they went into stadiums. And all of a sudden, Max Weinberg's sound, his drums and his toms, began to take on a life of themselves and sound very, very different. Like, they were sort of predated the Rick Allen kind of, hysteria sound. And I just want to touch on that real quick because I think it definitely altered the nuances in the band and, the aesthetic, especially on some of the older material. What did you guys think about that, Flynn?
First off, it actually happened way before the stadiums. We were talking to a friend of mine tonight, and we were trying to pinpoint
the exact moment.
Exactly. We were trying to say, this was the first show to have the new drum triggers.
I bet Ben Lazar knows the exact moment that happened.
All right, Ben.
Would say it was September, early October when it happened.
That's exactly right. It was between my friend actually said it was between the Philadelphia stand, which ended September 18th, mm-hmm. and Pittsburgh, which was like September 22nd.
Yeah.
So between Philly and Pittsburgh, somewhere on the Pennsylvania Turnpike, they lost the real drums.
And we're going to really geek out because they did it in stages. First, they triggered the toms, and then they did the snare later.
Oh, wow.
To be consistent.
And well, somebody's going to have to justify why this does elevate above geek talk, the drum sound. Can somebody articulate why that is actually important?
I can. Go ahead, John.
I just wanted to add one quick thing. I think the change in a drum sound, you know, drastically altered the sound of the band, much more so if you go back and you listen to those tapes. And we're going to play some stuff later in the show that specifically illustrates this point. But if you listen to some of the older songs like Racing in the Street, all of a sudden, you know, the crescendo is building at the end and you hear which are the tom fills and you're like, what is going on? I think it made a very big difference in the band's sound.
I think it ties into the whole muscularity of both Springsteen, the sound, and we said use the word Bruce on steroids. That sound was Bruce on steroids.
Compensating for the, you know. For
See, it becomes anthemic, though. It gives it an anthemic quality to it, which is just this largeness. And it's basically, you know, to me, it's a signal. Mm. You know, it's an arrival. And it portends, I think, the stuff that comes.
See, when we talk about Bruce on steroids, for me, being in the car, hearing Born to Run for the first time over the radio, and hearing that explosion at that time, I had never heard anything like that before. To me, that was Bruce on steroids back then, with the drum sound and the Spectorous type of production that was going on. That was huge.
But that was a natural – I'm sorry. But that was a natural sound.
But it was huge.
And the part that's interesting too is that when they got around to putting out the live album, you know, 1975 to 1985, that drum sound was definitely dialed – down and sound much more like the Born in the USA album. Like if you go back and you re-listen to the opening part of Glory Days, it sounds like a machine gun. Like it hasn't aged a day. But if you go back and you listen to the live tapes in that show, it sounds pretty outdated and antiquated at this point in time.
I think one of the key moments in the tour, there were many key moments to the Born in the USA tour, but I think one of the first real key moments was in September of 1984 in New Jersey, and this was not Bruce Springsteen. This was President Ronald Reagan running for re-election when he mentioned Bruce in a campaign speech in – I forget the name of the town, Flynn. You remember the name of the town?
No, I don't.
Haddington, New Jersey, I believe, or something like that. Anyway.
Certainly not a blue-collar stronghold, I would venture.
Anyway, so you know, Bruce responded to his next show in Pittsburgh saying that – you know, the president mentioned my name the other day, and I got to wondering what his favorite album is, and I don't think it's Nebraska, and then he went into Johnny 99. Yvonne, how do you think Bruce handled the whole kind of attempted co-optation of Bruce by President Reagan and the right? And I think more importantly, and other people can speak to this, what effect did it have on Bruce and the tour? Because there is a definite marked shift from that moment and the rest of the tour.
I think he handled it carefully. I think that he handled it with the same – this is just opinion and perception. But my sense was that this was a performer, a musician who felt that his deeds spoke more to who he was than what he was saying. And I think his deeds and prior stuff that he had done, his position was unassailable. I mean, he did Muse. He did the No Nukes kind. We knew where he was at without him having to tell us where he was at. He showed us where his heart was at.
But you've got millions of new fans who have none of that background, have none of that context. What they know of is the guy who they see on the CBS Evening News with his fist in the air saying, "I was born in the USA." So, you know, that's all happening while this Reagan thing's happening. So now what begins to kind of snowball is a huge misunderstanding of what Bruce Springsteen, who Bruce Springsteen is, what his music is about, and what the message is.
Yeah, no fault of his own, though. He would say to you, I think, you're not obviously listening to the lyrics because the lyrics would tell you something completely different.
Absolutely.
Well, does that mean, did you think he went darker at that point and he reacted to Reagan, Flynn?
He definitely did. I think from that point on, he was talking about this land is your land. I mean, he had done it in 1981, but I don't think he had done it on the USA tour up to that point. And I don't remember any food banks in the lobby in New Jersey at the Meadowlands stand. But as soon as he hit Pittsburgh, man, those auto workers unions and the food banks.
Maybe it was a wake up call to maybe even himself that the sort of things had sort of gotten somewhere, or that it was being misrepresented, or people were. The train was sort of leaving the station, and he wasn't maybe riding or controlling the train anymore. I don't know.
I agree with you because, you know, here's a recording artist, and all of a sudden, the president of the United States is commenting on his music, a song of his. That's the president of the United States. His message is going out to billions of people around the world, and he's mentioning this song as representing the United States. And Bruce Springsteen is singing something entirely different.
You know, at this time, I want to pull up an interesting quote. In a conversation Bruce had with John Hammond, he said at the time, you know, when you start to get real popular, you have to be careful that there isn't a delusion in some very simplistic terms of what you're doing. There are times when you have to get up and say, wait a minute, this isn't right. This is it. And this is the way I feel. And I think Bruce really wore his heart on his sleeve, and there was definitely a change in his demeanor as the tour progressed moving forward.
Now, I got to jump in on this. It's interesting. When Reagan made that quote, at the next show, maybe next several shows, he said, well, I don't, maybe the president has not been listening to this one, and then played Nebraska or Johnny 99. But he never when he said that, he was reaching 20,000 people a night.
Right.
He never came out and said it through through his publicity firm.
That's right.
A couple years ago, I think, I forget whether it was 04 or 06, 04,
yeah.
The Republican candidate was playing, I guess Bush was playing Born in the USA in his hometown or something.
And they put a stop to
it. In Red Bank. He came out, he sent them a letter. Shorefire sent out a press release immediately.
Yep.
Okay, he didn't do that in 84. Now, I don't know.
Well, I think that was part of his evolution. I mean, Bruce was very apolitical. I mean, he said he didn't vote. I said the only time he'd ever voted was in 1972. He voted for McGovern.
I also think he was very, very cautious, too.
Extremely cautious.
Know, as his career was skyrocketing, I think he realized what was at stake and was very, very careful about what he didn't say. And I think he let the songs really say what he didn't say.
Well, the only thing I would say to that is that I think Bruce knew that taking Reagan head on would do him absolutely no good. There was a great Rolling Stone interview that came out in December that Kurt Loder did, December of 84, where he really disavowed Reagan, was very eloquent in the interview. But doing it from the stage, you know, Bruce has always been very welcoming to everyone. I mean, even when he's gotten more explicit politically, he said from the stage, we welcome all kinds here. Bruce has never been interested in preaching just to the converted. He wanted to reach both people on the left and the right. He's someone who believed that music transcends all those barriers of class and politics and race, even though they've never been really successful crossing over to a black audience. So I think Bruce really wanted to let the music do the talking. And that's something I think he's done consistently throughout his career. I mean, we don't want to get into this conversation now, but you look at 41 Shots, Bruce never explicitly
explained it.
Right. He let the music do the talking.
Well, just going back to in 84, letting the music do the talking is that the people didn't hear the music always.
No, they heard what they wanted to hear.
Right, they heard what they wanted to hear.
They responded to basically a jingoistic chorus that made them feel good, whatever end of the spectrum they were at. But those that were listening and those that were, you know, paying attention, there was no ambiguity in this message.
It was perfectly clear.
Well, you know what? The thing is, though, I'm going to disagree with that just because I think it wasn't just people on the right. You take people on the left, too, who, you know, would be very sympathetic to Bruce Springsteen, and they all of a sudden thought of him as some sort of Rambo right-wing rock guy. I think, you know, in the short term, there was a lot of money being misunderstood.
Yep.
In the long term of it, I think Bruce got painted as a jingoistic rocker, both on the right and the left. And I think it took him some time to kind of become undone and for him to be understood for who he really is. Now I think it's crystal clear who Bruce Springsteen is, and people on the left and the right would say, oh, yeah, I know where he stands. In 1984, I would say that wasn't the case.
And also, you know, when he went into stadiums in Europe and was playing that song, you know, as much as the Europeans loved him and he was gigantic over there and the response was outrageous, I don't even know if they really understood what the song was about. You know, you've got – the first time I saw Bruce in Italy.
I'm sorry to interrupt. There's a great story how Little Steven in 85 – when he was traveling with the band, had to defend Bruce and the song from like left-wing Europeans who were attacking Bruce for being too patriotic.
Too jingoistic.
Yeah, so it was completely misunderstood on the left and the right.
Well, you can understand, though, why it was misunderstood, which is probably speaks to his reaction to that, because his body language and his band and a lot of other things were telling the story that they were hearing, even though the – so maybe – the lyrics were there, but they weren't being heard because everything else told the pump your fist in the air USA.
Well, thing. You know, and I think that speaks to Bruce's brilliance as a writer and performer, that you can actually be, you know, you can be critical and patriotic. Right. Most people don't see things. It's got to be one way or the other. And, you know, I think one of the genius of Bruce Springsteen is that you can hold both of those things simultaneously and express them. And I think that's what Born in the USA is.
You know, it's interesting. It brings up a really great Robert Crisco quote from around that period, too, where he talks about – he simply says, articulating the contradictions of freedom and powerlessness in America for both teenagers who still believe they're born to run and adults who know where they end up. And I think that illustrates a really good point as to what we're talking about in this part of the conversation.
Just one last thing, and I'll pick it up from Ben, and I would suggest that perhaps what Bruce might have been intimating at is to be a true patriot is to be critical and that you can do that.
And just to say one thing myself on this is that I think Bruce had a realization that two realizations really. One, from one point of view, you can't fight, and I don't want to fight City Hall on their level, and I will be very careful. The word that you used, it was very very
cautious.
Very cautious and careful about how I speak, because these are powerful men with powerful positions. There's no need for me to take them on their level.
It's like getting pulled over by a cop. Most of the time, you just want to pay the ticket and keep driving.
And keep driving. So I think that's very important. And I think from there, from that time in his career, he was really able to take off.
Stu, that's a great point, Stu. We're going to play a little music here. We'll be right back after this song. We'll be right back.
Thanks a lot. I'd like to just take a minute and thank everybody for coming down to the show tonight. Thank you very much. And I'd like to do a song for you. I guess I'd like to do this once again for my folks. They don't get to come out and see me that much. So, on my best behavior. And for my in-laws. Yeah. But this is a song, I guess it's about the greatest song ever written about America. And it's by Woody Guthrie, and I guess what's so great about it is it gets right to the heart of the promise of what our country was supposed to be about. And as we sit here tonight, that's a promise that is eroding every day for many of our fellow citizens. I don't think that if you talk to the steel workers in the Munyaw Valley, I don't think they'd believe that this song was true anymore. I don't know if it is, but I know that it ought to be. And I'd like to do this for you, wishing you all the longest life, with the best of everything, and reminding you that with countries, just like with people, it's easy to let the best of yourself slip away. Once I rode that ribbon highway, I saw above me the endless sky. I saw below me the golden berry. This land was made for you and me. I roamed and I rambled, and I followed my footsteps through the sparkling sands of her diamond deserts. And all around me, a voice was sounding. It cried, this land was made for you and me. Well, the sun came shining as I went strolling through her wheat fields waving and her dust clouds rolling and her bells were ringing. The fog was lifting. Well, I seen this land was made for you and one Sunday morning, in the shadow of the steeple, by the relief office, I saw the people, and they were hungry, and they were wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to New York Island, from the Redwood Forests to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. Thank you.
All right, welcome back, everyone, to the Springsteen Community Conference on East Street Radio. We're talking about the 25th anniversary of the Born in the USA album, tour, and phenomenon. So after the fall 1984 tour, the band resumed playing arenas in the winter of 85 in the States, and then went to Australia, and then Japan, and then Europe, where they played stadiums extensively and exclusively. When the tour resumed in the United States in August of 85, Bruce was now something bigger than just an enormous rock star. He was something akin to a phenomenon. Who would like to say what it was like in the summer of 85, just in terms of the whole Bruce Springsteen experience? Lewis?
Well, thank you. It was before I started in radio at K-Rock in Los Angeles. And you could not run away from Bruce Springsteen if you wanted to. You had to live in a cave to not hear him and come out of every orifice of entertainment that there was. And MTV was like playing, what, 5 videos at that point in heavy rotation. And there was just, it felt like for me even personally, I didn't go to the arena. When it came to the Coliseum, I had gone to the sports arena shows. I lived in Los Angeles. I started getting Bruce fatigued.
Bruced out.
And I loved him so much, but it just seemed like it had gone so much beyond anything anybody can control. Was it, at what point also, esteemed panel of colleagues, did he meet his first wife?
That would be in October of 84 in Los Angeles.
So that was beforehand. So does that also affect the sort of the... you know, the fairy tale-ness and the surrealness of the whole experience.
Take that one, Flynn.
You know, he...
Because, well, by the way, you're also talking about nobody could make it through. He did about as good a job as any human being could with making through this and still being, like, having some kind of integrity. And still having
tour.
And still having people love him, because people don't make it through those kind of phenomenons and not have... something terrible happen creatively or to their personal lives where they just lose the plot. Everybody from Elvis Presley to, you know, to Guns N' Roses, that he held on is stunning and a testimonial to him. But still at the time, it was pretty nutty.
Well, in some ways, I mean, he went bigger. You know, the shows, like, you know, in November, I think you can almost consider some of the best of that tour between Kansas City and whatever the Sugarland recording
Lincoln,
is.
Lincoln, Nebraska, I think it is.
Lincoln,
yeah.
Nebraska, sounds, yeah, right. You know, those are some great shows. And then going into December, they were focused. They had a good narrative arc to them. And what you had, the 4 or 5 Nebraska songs. And, you know, they had a purpose. They felt like Bruce Springsteen shows.
Were they having fun?
They are having fun, but Bruce was being a little bit serious in the middle, too. With the, like I said, with the Nebraska tracks, which I include Follow That Dream and Shut Out the Light as being Nebraska-esque. Mm. Then I think it just, he was loving life. He was on top of the world and he knew it. Mm. He was big and he knew it and he was enjoying it. And, you know, he didn't go into drugs or drinking. But he got a trophy wife basically. Mm. And, you know, he was on top of that world.
Stu, you want to chime in on there?
One of the things that I remember most about it was on my way to the show in upstate New York, was an amphitheater that he played. I had to drop off at my mom's place, and I got to the door. My mom had this light in her eyes, this glint that I had never seen before, and she's talking to my aunt, and she says, you know, yeah, Stu's going to the Bruce Springsteen show. And I had never heard my mother talk about rock and roll on any level. I mean, she's in her 60s and everything, but she had this joy in her. About, wow, I'm going to see Bruce, and my son's going to see Bruce. And I realized in that moment that this is bigger than the River was, the River Tour or Nassau Coliseum. When I saw him there, it was more universal, it was a bigger experience.
And I would even say it's bigger than rock and roll. The tour transcended rock and roll.
Absolutely. It was a transcendent moment. And then when I'm at the show and I realize I don't have a seat, I'm sitting on the mountain, and there's these two huge screens that I'm watching the show on the screen, I realize, yes, Nassau Coliseum was big, but Born in the USA tour is huge. He has now definitely hit the big time, and there's no stopping him. And that's what I really remember.
You know, one of my memories is the first night that Bruce played at Giant Stadium, I didn't go to the show. I went to a couple shows later. And on CBS Channel 2, they had these people talking about Bruce because they did like 20 minutes on Bruce playing Giant Stadium. And they had all these people who knew nothing about music, knew nothing about Bruce Springsteen, knew nothing about rock and roll, talking about where Bruce Springsteen stands, you know, in music history, and these like know-nothings embarrassing themselves. I was like, oh man, like this is getting really ridiculous. Now, it didn't affect my love of Bruce or my excitement.
Right.
And me personally, like, you know, I'm not one of those people that like, oh, this is, I want this to be a secret. I wanted Bruce Springsteen's music to be shared with everyone because it made such a huge difference in my life that I thought it would make the same difference in other people's lives. And for me personally, I think one of the disappointments was there were a lot of casual fans who just didn't get it the way I got it. It was just the big rock show. And, you know, some people got it and stuck around.
And that's a weird feeling.
Yeah. I mean, because you know how much this music has affected, you know, all of us here at this table.
Absolutely.
And to have people go to the show because it's the hot show. And then like, oh, yeah, it was good. It was almost disconcerting to me. Yvonne?
I had seen probably a half dozen of the dates. And I remember I'd seen the Rosemont shows in Chicago and then had moved to New York and was working at a record company and had parlayed whatever favors I could, and I got some tickets, and I'd seen the Giant Stadium shows, and I took my sister, who was not a fan, and I reached a saturation point, I think. I think at that point, I reverted to this oblique snobbery, probably, because I'm sitting in Giant Stadium with, what is that, 60,000, 70,000 with these huge screens, and I'm thinking, this is really a long haul from working in a little hole-in-the-wall record store in Chicago and people walking out of the store because we were playing Greetings from Asbury Park or The Wild and The Innocent and saying, you know, get that crap off the turntable. And thinking, you know, this is – but I've lost something. I felt like I lost something. And that's and I recognize that that's a kind of snobbish thing. That, but I
well,
felt
it's
that
it, not. It's you could see it happened to it happened to U2 during like when they went stadium right. after that Rattle and Hum time. Mm-hmm. There were still some good moments on that album, but there's still something that got lost, and they would sort of look back on that time and say, you know, we went a little off track there. But it's how can you not?
Well, I think that the beauty in Bruce is that he's able to bring you back. He's like, you know, it's like Al Pacino in The Godfather 3. Just when you thought you're out, they'll bring you back.
Well,
in.
And I would also say the distinction I would make between Bruce and U2 during the Joshua Tree period is I don't think Bruce looks back on it and thinks of it as a misstep. I think Bruce is glad he did it.
I agree.
He was glad when it was over also, but he did it as right as he could with what he knew then. And
I might look back at it and go, you know, it was the muscles a little too much, the bandana. I don't know about the bandana. You know, I probably would have synced up the Born in the USA video if I could do it all over again. You know, there's a few things he would probably just tone down. Maybe he wouldn't, whatever, you know.
Minor complaints compared to the Rattle and Hum version of Helter Skelter.
Correct, Mundo.
Minor complaints compared to the fucking Lemon.
Easy, Tiger.
Lemon, anybody?
Flynn, go ahead.
Well, one thing. If we ever get a chance to do, like, an interview for us with Bruce Springsteen, like, the questions that the hardcore fans want to know, I want that interviewer to say, Bruce, when you look back on the Born in the USA tour and all the stuff that came with it, what do you remember most? What sticks with you the most? What, you know, when you started that tour, what did you plan on doing? When you ended the tour, do you feel like you accomplished what you wanted? You know, those are the questions. I mean, of course, I want to do that with every tour with him. But
I think
that's
a great question.
But I think at this point, we're just talking about the USA. And like, we all want to know how does he look back on that period?
Well, the transformation between the beginning of that tour and the end of it, I don't think there's ever been in his career, there's ever been a transformation like it. I mean, he started out as an enormous rock star, but he became just a superhero.
Well, and 15 million records later. And I mean, I think he comes away with when I use this term, he comes away from this with a tremendous amount of currency, and I'm not talking about
dignity,
but currency as an artist, as a writer, as a persona, as a musician, and I think that's huge.
I think from that point on, he could do anything he wanted.
Yeah,
because the confidence level is beyond
no
at this
question.
Point.
Well, and the record company is, you know, they you know, he made them a lot of money for those three, you know, from 84 through the live record.
You know, the one thing I want to come back to, and I don't think we've really touched on this all that much so far, is like, you know, I really want to touch upon the album You know, like, here is an artist who came off Nebraska, amazing album. The River, another amazing album. Darkness, I think one of his best records. Born to Run, a bona fide classic. I just want to talk about how the Born in the USA album stacks up against those records and also, you know, against his future catalog. Flynn, what do you think?
Well, one of the things I remember about Bruce himself talking about that album is that he called it a good rock record. I think Kurt Loder asked him how he looked back on that album 3 years later during the Tunnel of Love tour, and he said it's a good rock record. Not necessarily the one that he set out to make, but it was a good rock record. You know, I love those songs. You know, I'm one of the bandwagon fans from that era. I didn't see him then at that point. I was, you know, 13, 14 years old, and actually the week he was playing RFK Stadium, August 5th in 85, I was in California. So I didn't even have a chance of seeing him on that tour. But, you know, I can't – there's a lot of songs on that album that at this point, in some ways, I don't ever want to hear again.
Stu, what do you think?
Well, you know, I think it stacks up well. There are some of the songs, and I agree with you, Flynn, some of the songs I have a hard time listening to. But when I hadn't heard it for a while, and I played it recently, and Born in the USA still rings for me. My Hometown still rings for me. Glory Days still rings for me.
I mean, can we agree that Born in the USA is one of the best Bruce Springsteen songs ever? Can we agree on that?
We can agree on that.
We can agree on that, because here we are 25 years later, and we're still discussing it, and that song is still current today. And we all know it, because in the conditions that we have in our country today, we have two wars going on, and that song still rings true. You know, they're still there, he's all gone. That line will always be there. It is embedded in our consciousness. And I think that song has a timeless quality, as does the album, as does much of his catalog, has a timeless quality to it you can't deny.
Flynn, what do you think?
Well, just to illustrate the point about Born in the USA being timeless, I remember seeing Bruce in March of 03 on the Rising Tour as we were marching toward the Iraqi conflict. And Bruce said, I wrote this song 20 years ago. Don't make me write it again.
Heavy.
And, you know, just I think it's a classic album. I've listened to it recently. I don't think there's a bum song on it.
It sort of went through a downtime in people's minds or something, but it's been coming back lately. I think it's resurrecting itself somewhat.
I think it got punished for its popularity for a while.
I completely agree.
And I just think it's another classic, amazing Springsteen record. There are a lot of hardcore Springsteen fans who've got problems with Cover Me. I don't know why.
I don't have a problem with that song.
That song's amazing.
I don't have a problem with that.
I think Darling County. I mean, even something like Working on the Highway, which I think people are quick to dismiss.
I defend Working on the Highway. A highlight of the last tour when he did the Born in the USA album in full was excellent. Like the Buddy Holly vibe, killer. He had a nice little dance, a little Elvis dance. Very sweet.
That one line, I look straight at her and she looks straight back. That line kills me every single time.
How many shows did you see in 99?
20-something?
Yeah, 20, 25.
I mean...
And you didn't get sick of it?
I got sick of it, but I can get sick of any song if he plays it every night. I mean, I get sick of Thunder Road if he plays it every night.
Real quick, didn't he open with Born in the USA every single show during the Born in the USA tour?
No.
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 No. First part of it?
No. Thunder Road and Badlands were...
And Born in the USA, they rotated.
They rotated. And it was in Detroit.
Born in the USA, like 70% maybe?
In July, when they played Detroit, that's when Born in the USA became the consistent
opener
for the rest of the tour.
Except for
July 4th, 1985 in London, where they opened with an acoustic version of Independence Day.
You know, the one thing...
Wrought with irony is Bruce Springsteen played London, England on our country's 209th birthday.
Yeah. You know, the one thing I think, I think distance with this album is a really key thing, you know. And again, having not listened to it in a long time, revisiting it this past week, getting ready for the show, I stack up this album against, you know, other enormous, huge 80s albums like Thriller, Purple The Joshua Rain. Tree, Purple Rain, you know, Hysteria by Def Leppard, another, you know, complete classic album of that era. And I honestly think Born in the USA stacks up really, really well against all those records and has aged tremendously well. Again, I keep going back to this. If you listen to Glory Days or Darlington County, the production on it is absolutely stellar and timeless. It sounds like it was recorded last week.
And, you know, the one thing I would say is, you know, we live now in a very musically fragmented world. You know, those records you just mentioned, Prince, Madonna, Michael Jackson, Bruce, The Police the year before – you know, if that was like, if those were the biggest bands in the world, then the world was doing pretty good, I've got to say. I mean, all those artists were seminal artists who were making great records and reaching a ton of people. And that is something that is long gone.
And every one of those records has bona fide, perfect pop songs on it, whether it's Purple Rain, Where the Streets Have No Name, you know, for the lack of a better comparison, Pour Some Sugar on Me. Those are perfect pop songs. And I think Born in the USA is chock full of perfect pop songs. Mervos?
I'm going to agree with Bruce and say that, you know, for me, that Born in the USA is a really good rock record.
But he said that like 3 years after. If he looked back on it now and put it against his body of work, he might say, yeah, I think that's more than a rock record. I think that's really something special.
See, for me, Ben and I have had this conversation. I don't know that it would even be a top five record for me in Bruce's catalog. And again,
wow, really?
But I have to contextualize this because everything's got to be put in context.
You mean like you're old?
Well,
my kid because I love
much it. Love, Lewis. Much love. No, you know what the real issue is? The real issue, and again, you'll identify with this, Lewis, is that I was at radio and I beat the shit out of that record. I played it incessantly.
You were bruised out.
I was bruised out, and that record was, you know, it was. I left radio, went into records, and, you know, what came for me really was Tunnel of Love, because having worked with Patty and then getting to go out on the road during that record was a completely different thing. And it was I saw what I thought was a monster jump in writing and performing.
So that brings up a really great topic, which we're going to get to in the next segment. We're going to play a little music right now. But next up, we're going to be talking about, you know, the aftermath of Born in the USA, the work that came next, the impact on Bruce and Bruce's music from here on in. So we'll be right back.
Let's go.
And we're back on East Street Radio. It's John Frank. Thanks for tuning in to this great roundtable discussion about the Born in the USA Tour 25th anniversary. We're going to delve into, the aftermath of the giant Born in the USA time in, and its place in the pantheon of rock music and talk about a little bit, where did Bruce go next? What was the aftermath of the tour? You know, as an artist, he definitely changed things up and went in a different direction. Wanted to touch upon that.
You know, Bruce has talked about really in the aftermath of Born in the USA, he really wanted to reintroduce himself as a songwriter and really work in a much less iconic format. I mean, after the tour, they did the live album, which, I think was the most hyped thing Bruce ever did. I mean, the press on that was insane. I remember, this really helped bring the CD into prominence and, it was crazy. But after that died... Mervos, you have something?
Not true. The Born in the USA was the first domestic CD manufactured by Columbia at the Terre Haute factory. Prior to that, every Columbia CBS CD was actually shipped in from Japan. But you're right.
It was something that really brought the
multiple,
CD
to, it was a box set. Yeah. Absolutely.
But I think
he's talking about the live set.
The live album, yeah, the live
75,
set.
85.
Yeah.
And I think, there were two things happening simultaneously. I think there was the beginning of a backlash, which was kind of inevitable given how big he was. And then in October of 87, he came out with Tunnel of Love, which is a much smaller record. And in my opinion, it's his best record. I mean, I love that record. I think that record is, really what divides the aficionados from everyone else. I think that record is just pure genius. But it's clearly not Born in the USA. Columbia Records, I remember an interview with Walter Yetnikoff in 1988 saying something like, well, saying somewhat snidely, well, Tunnel of Love isn't Born in the USA, but would you still want Bruce Springsteen on your label? So, in the 80s, everything got so much bigger. And I remember the top 10 being on Entertainment Tonight, it became a game of numbers. And just because Bruce Springsteen wasn't matching the Born in the USA numbers, people were considering it a failure.
Well, it was also the tone of the album, because it wasn't that sort of steroid, anthemic Born in the USA. It was sort of reflective and pensive and whatever, so melancholy.
Go ahead. It was a period of time where he was going through a divorce, and almost every
But nobody
song,
knew it at no, the time.
No?
Divorce didn't really start happening until the tour started.
Okay.
But when the album came out in the fall of 87, obviously, a lot of people interpret it when they heard it as though something was amiss in Paradise.
Well, you know, that's how I got – that's what I took from it when I was listening to it, because it seemed like every song, almost every song on it had this sadness about it, this melancholy-ish about it, about lost love, about something amiss in a relationship, and the striving to reconcile. And I think that's where the beauty of that album came out. It was unlike any other Bruce I'd heard up to that point. You know, it was different than Darkness. It was different than Born in the USA, different than Born to Run and The River. It had a certain wish to it.
It was personal.
So, you know, one thing that was happening in the, you know, after the live album in the late 80s, even into the early 90s, was a real backlash against Bruce. Not particularly heavy. He was obviously still selling out arenas, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, it became somewhat uncool to be in like Bruce Springsteen. So, Flynn, you want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, he basically became too big. He became a cultural cliche. You know, even though he had massive audience growth every year up to USA, he just exploded. And he was underground. You can say he was basically an underground act and to some extent.
He was a cult artist.
Cult. That's a better word, yes. He was a cult artist until 1984, until USA got released. And then everybody knew him. You know, he wasn't like somebody's... Like, you know, I got this great artist here. You know, I got this great singer. He's great.
I think he stopped being cool.
Right. He stopped being cool. And here's something I realized the other day as I was, you know, thinking about the backlash or the post-USA era is that in 82, 83, Fast Times at Ridgemont High came out? All right. Judge Reinhold's character, he kept having, you know, the Bruce shirts, the Jersey Devil, and they were all bootleg shirts, which I thought was really cool. But then in 1985, getting Springsteen tickets was a plot of Growing Pains.
The first Growing Pains, I believe it was. I think the first episode of Growing Pains is a shot of Kirk Cameron's ass posing.
Oh, this
like,
is Geek Fest.
This is when it...
This is Geek Fest.
Posing like the Born in the USA album cover.
Okay. Chuck, so, please.
So you go from, you know, Fast Times at Ridgemont High and the cool, you know, cool ethics going on there to Growing Pains, you know, a family sitcom from the mid-80s. And... That shows that fall.
But what's also interesting is that his career, you know, similar to Wall Street, went through like a correction, if you think about it, you know, because Tunnel of Love, when it came out, and also keep in mind, he played stadiums in Europe on the Tunnel of Love tour, and he sold out stadiums on Tunnel of Love tour. I don't think he played stadiums in America on Tunnel of Love tour, right?
No, well, he did arenas.
He did arenas, but he might have done stadiums because he didn't come back to the States. He did Amnesty International instead.
Right.
Which was stadium.
Yeah.
But that album, even when it came out and everything about it, like, you know, the bigness of it was way dialed down for Born in USA. And I think it's an amazing record, and I think it was more of a conscious decision
than we
think.
Bruce has spoken to it. He said, I knew that this was a blip in my career. I knew that this was a one-time only deal and that my audience would go back down to a much more manageable size after it was over.
There were. Can I confess something to all this esteemed panel of Bruce Springsteen experts? So I literally stopped listening to Springsteen for like 6 years. I just stopped like after Tunnel of Love, like 90, right before the two albums came out, and I didn't get back in until like 97.
And why was that, Lewis?
Because I was, as Bruce himself was, I was fatigued. I have vivid memories. Who remembers the video with like the European tour highlights and then just the waving and the pumping?
Born to Run.
Born to Run tour. Yeah, for the live album, live video of Born to Run, a montage. Yeah,
that was, I think, contributed to it because it's so, the image of him was so defined. It was so you could not get away from it. And it was, it left nothing to the imagination. There was no sort of, variance. It was just right there in front, and that's what I think speaks to the conversation that we're having right now.
Right. Well, I was going to say, going back to the Tunnel of Love tour, in terms of it being in a reaction to the Born in the USA era, I mean, the album, he scaled it down, as you said, and that was intentional. But I find it interesting that while he shook up some of the things on stage, he reverted to old habits pretty quickly. You know, he brought the horns up, and he said, Patty, you stand on this side, Clarence, you stand on that side. You know, mix things up, try to make things fresh again. But, you know, it didn't take very long.
But yeah, by the end, you know, he started the tour playing 8 songs from Tunnel and 5 from Born in the USA. By the end of the tour in Europe, he was playing 8 songs from Born in the USA and 5 from Tunnel. Man. And I think that really leads to him breaking up the band.
Yeah, it was like,
I think, you know, Bruce has said that after when he did the live album at the end of the Born in the USA experience, he felt an era was over. And I think really the ambivalence that he showed about the band on the Tunnel of Love tour spoke. He didn't know what the next move was.
There was no next move. Where do you go? Where can you go from there?
And I think it took him a long time to figure out what to do next. And I think that was why it took 5 years between Tunnel of Love and then, you know, Human Touch and Lucky Town. Really, obviously, he started a family. He hooked up with Patty. But really, artistically, it took him a long time to find his bearings again.
For me, artistically, it really was hearing, for the first time, the ghost of Tom Joad. When I heard that, to me, that was a return to form. There was no question.
I would have to echo that as well. I think that
I agree too.
I think that when we really stand back and look at this, and again, we afford him the courtesy of a writer and looking at the body of work, and we see it as, again, as certainly most of you would agree, there is an arc and there's a developmental arc here. And as a writer in the most truest sense, in the most profound sense, I mean, coming off the blockbuster of something like, you know, Born in the USA. I mean, if we, you know, use parallels between, you know, John Updike or Philip Roth or, you know, Jim Harrison or other American writers, you know, I think we have to allow them the opportunity to come back down off of something like that, regroup. And I think that, you know, to speak to Tunnel of Love and the stuff that comes after, I think that we're looking at an internal landscape. I mean, he had externalized so much, I think, in Born in the USA and took on the big issues, the big meat and potato stuff. And I think you come back to Tunnel of Love. Tunnel of Love is so profound because, again, it's this internal landscape of love lost, love ventured, love lost. I mean, that's, you know, Ben and I have spoken. I mean, that is one of my favorite. That is one of my top five records, as is Ghost.
Yeah, you know, with Ghost, you know, one of the things I was thinking about it, and this, is, again, is just my opinion. You know, I felt it as the ghost of Bruce Springsteen because I felt he had left, he came to terms with the ghost of his past and was really going to the next step on this album. You
know, left the bandana behind, so to speak.
Left it all behind. Yeah. Yeah. You know, and
Slimmed down,
and here I am. Here I am now. Those are my ghosts, and I'm moving on. Come with me if you want, but this is where I am now. And it was a profound moment when I first heard it.
Flynn, where do you look back in terms of when you listen to the shows, where do you stack up the tour against other Bruce Springsteen tours?
That's a good question. I would put up the, as I said earlier, the November 84 shows, I guess the fall of 84, October through December, as some of the best from his career. I think you obviously had the joyousness of the album.
Lewis, you went to some of those shows. You went to the Sports Arena shows in October of 84, right?
They were beyond fantastic, but compared to the River Tour, for me personally, it just seemed like it had less of that grit or something.
It was more polished,
and it was a great polished, but I don't know, something peaked for me in the River. That was the moment.
Ben and I talked about it. I think it's the transition from the Soul Review, which the River still had, that kind of, again, and Flynn spoke about, you know, the Church of Rock and Roll, and now you're just moving into spectacle.
Right, it went from the show band vibe to you know, enormity.
And then a pop thing, and it's, I don't know why I'm bringing this up, but if you read the Andy Warhol diaries, there are two entries on Springsteen. There's one where he sees Springsteen in 78 at the Garden, a time that all of us would is like Springsteen Valhalla, 78, the Garden, oh my God. And Warhol completely doesn't get it. The next section is 85, sees him at Giant Stadium. Oh my God, he looks so much better now. I love the show. Yeah. So it was a pop show. Yeah. It became a, I mean, obviously he's still a rocker, but it became a pop show for pop people to get.
It's like the difference, Rolling Stones, Tattoo U Tour, or Get Your Yah Yahs Out, 69, right? There was a different vibe, right?
Well, I mean, for me, it would be the Aftermath Tour in 65. No, wait a minute. No, bear with me here because
you're
it's only...
You whippersnappers out there!
No. You know, 65 to 4 years later to Altamont. You know, and you're talking about a huge arc there in a period of 4 years.
That's Jovan Mervos, the Forrest Gump of rock and roll.
Yes,
people.
That's me. That's me, the Zelig. I was there.
Flynn, did you, you know, get your answer in terms of everything you wanted to say about the tour and how it stacks up?
Well, I, those November, October through December shows, and the reason I like those shows a lot is because it has those extended Nebraska sets. Atlantic City, Johnny 99, Reason to Believe,
those are great
Shut
numbers.
Out the Light,
yeah.
And Johnny Bye Bye Johnny or Johnny Bye Bye, yeah. whatever.
I think
it's called.
We can overstate and underestimate how important those songs were in the context of the show and how great those songs were. And even the outtakes, Shut Out the Light, Johnny Bye Bye, going back to them now, they sound exceptional.
Well, they were B-sides.
And I think they definitely had a huge part in telling the story he was trying to tell. And also, to Bruce's credit, I can't think of any other artist that could silence the stadium into playing Reason to Believe and have people actually pay attention. Whether or not they got the message or understood the song is a different question. But he just, he murdered that.
It takes balls to play five of those songs in a row to an arena audience. I don't care what you say. I mean, that takes courage and that takes a real belief in what you're doing.
Well, no, I think it was mentioned before. It's confidence. And not an arrogance or hubris, but it's just that confidence of knowing who you are, what your band is capable of, knowing your material. And also, I think, trusting your audience and having that intimate relationship with the audience.
And the amazing part, too, is that, those Nebraska songs have been reinvented over the years into different versions that have been, the one's more incredible than the other. Whether it's the Seeger Sessions of the Atlantic City version or, the Devils and Dust Reason to Believe. Devils and Dust.
Reason to Believe
the harp rearrangement. Those songs are among the best songs of his career, and they fit thematically perfectly into the story he was trying to tell and into the arc of the show.
I couldn't pick a favorite song off the album of Nebraska. I had such a hard time. I was asked to, Stu, pick your favorite song. I said, I can't. It's such a piece in itself. It's a unit into itself. And that's why I said earlier it's a novel, because he's telling a story. And he's telling it through different characters and different realizations and different towns and along the road and the journey that we're all on. And he captures it so well on that record. There's no denying that.
And I think for those shows, the Nebraska material was literally the flip side of Born in the USA.
Absolutely. It gave it a balance. It gave it a perfect balance so his confidence could really shine through right there. He goes, I'm going to give you this, and I'm also going to give you this.
And that was, that was also a pretty big test for an audience to sit through, 17 to 20 new songs, yeah. In the context of a tour. And while he did that later on in his career with Human Touch and Lucky Town, and he also did it on the river because he played a lot of unreleased material on that tour as well. It just, given the enormity of the tour, it took a lot of guts to do that.
I just have this vivid memory of going to a Black Crow show, and then they, all right, this is from the new album. And then I went out and went to the bathroom, and I'm standing there, and I'm at the urinal. The guy next to me goes, yeah, every time they say, here's a new one, it's bathroom time.
See, I disagree with that 100%.
I would in this case, too, but I just, it was a non sequitur, and I'm not making the analogy, but I'm saying what heroic effort it was to do that, because it is such a tough sell to do that. Incredibly hard.
And also he's not doing an hour and a half show here. He's doing a 3-4 hour show. He's doing long shows, and the audience is with him. At least my experience of being in the audience, we were with him throughout every minute of that show.
And, I think
every minute.
All of us in the music business, we've seen so many bands. The more bands you see, the more you appreciate how phenomenal Bruce Springsteen is.
And he's doing it every night. He's going out there every night.
I mean,
and
it's just so singularly extraordinary.
When I saw Tom Petty for the first time and he played 2 hours, I was like, I want my money back. This is 2 hours? What is this?
Going back to the shows themselves and over the course of the tour, it was disappointing, at least looking back, where he went from playing five Nebraska songs to playing one in the stadiums. I was looking at the set list this week from the fall of 84 through the summer of 85. And I guess it was when he streamlined the show in Japan, where he had a curfew.
That's right.
So a lot of those songs got left off. And then when he went to stadiums, for whatever reason, I guess they stayed on the floor.
He thought he couldn't get away with it.
Right.
He may have been right.
Yeah. He probably was.
He probably was right.
I mean, you're playing RFK Stadium in front of, 90,000 people or whatever?
Oh, 50,
I mean, he would 55. He would play two songs. He'd play Atlantic City. I remember Johnny 99 was on everything. And Atlantic City he was playing pretty often, but it was electric, so it's not quite the same.
I mean, it was a rocker. It was not that different than Born in the USA.
Very much so.
We'll be right back after we spin some music.
Ralph went out looking for a job, but he couldn't find none. He came home too drunk from mixing tannery and wine. Got a gunshot at nightclub, now they call him Johnny 99. Down in the party town, where when you hit a red light, you don't stop. Johnny's waving his gun around, threatening in the boys' top. When an off-duty cop's knocked up on him from behind. Out in front of the club tip-top, they slap the cuffs on Johnny 99. Well, the city supplied a public defender, but the judge was me, John Brown. He came into the courtroom and stared poor Johnny down. Said the evidence is clear, won't let the sentence unfit the crime. Prison for 98 a year, we'll call it even Johnny 99. Mama stood up and shouted, "Judge, don't take my boy this way." Well, son, you got any statement you'd like to make before the bailiff comes to forever take you away? Well, judge, judge, I had debts no honest man could pay. A bank was holding my mortgage, they were gonna take my house away. Well, now I ain't saying that makes me an innocent man, but it was more than all this judge had put that gun in my hand. Now you're right, or I do believe I'd be better off dead. So if you can take a man's life for the thoughts that's in his head, let's sit back in that chair and think it over just one more time. Let him shave off my hair and put me on that executioner's line.
Maybe everything that dies someday comes back. Put your makeup on, fix your hair up pretty. Well, meet me tonight in Atlanta City. Now I got a job and I tried to put my money away, but I had debts I know. And I bought me and my baby two tickets on that Coast City bus. Everything dies, baby, that's a fact. But maybe everything that dies someday comes back. Put your makeup on, fix your hair up pretty, and make me a good night and then laughter. But the nights get cold. Maybe everything dies. Maybe that's the fact. But maybe everything that dies someday comes back. But it's hard to find, cause down here there's just winners and losers, and don't get caught on the wrong side of that line. But I'm tired of coming out on this losing end. So honey, last night I met this guy, and I'm gonna do a little favor for him. And I guess everything dies, maybe that's a fact. Maybe everything that dies someday comes back. Put your makeup on, put your hair up pretty, and meet me tonight in Atlantic City. Meet me tonight in Atlantic City. Meet me tonight in Atlantic City. Drop low!
E Street Radio, this is the Springsteen Community Conference. I'm Ben Lazar from A Deeper Shade of Soul.
So here's my last question. What do you think Bruce Springsteen's relationship is to those songs now? You know, he's done a couple of acoustic tours. He's done several tours with the E Street Band. Those songs have been a part of him. Who would like to speak to what, you know, you think Bruce's relationship to those songs is now?
You and I had this conversation earlier, and we used as the as a model, perhaps as an overlay, is does he take a Dylan approach to this? And some people would offer that Dylan has turned his material so inside out that you can barely identify it, and I think that's a fair argument. Although there are moments when he does do it that it works, and it's absolute brilliance on Dylan's part, and I would take a different leaf and maybe say, maybe like a jazz musician that would come back to this material. I mean, I would love to hear him come back to stuff off of The Wild, The Innocent, and Greetings, and see what, you know, 35, 40 years does to a song like, Sandy or... you know, take any of the stuff.
They haven't changed all that much. And I think the material...
You think it's a question that he stays true to
fidelity? On the acoustic tours, obviously, Bruce has done a zillion different kinds of versions of Born in the USA, the song.
I mean, that's that song.
That's that song. I mean,
I think there's a lot of songs we tend to forget about. I think just the deconstruction and reconstruction of Atlantic City alone.
Right.
Like there's three different amazing versions of that song. And while they're completely different, the acoustic one, the rock one, the Seeger Sessions one, they're all equally great. I'd have a very hard time picking, you know, among them. Same thing with Reason to Believe. There's, you know, the ZZ Top quote unquote version of it. There's the harmonica version of it, and there's the original version of
right,
it.
Right, but that's Nebraska. And you know, Born in the USA, the songs they remain pretty static. With I'd say the most inspired rearrangement in terms of an electric context has been his rearrangement of Dancing in the Dark, which he changed from a synth-led thing into right. a great guitar rocker starting on the Rising Tour. That's a great rearrangement.
That's the bathroom break.
Well, it's interesting to note that on the reunion tour, which was the first tour with the E Street Band in 11 years, that he didn't play any of the singles off the Born in the USA album.
He dug deep.
He still played Bobby. He played Bobby Jean. He played Working on the Highway. He played Darlington County.
Downbound Train.
Occasionally. Yeah. I'm on fire. I think I got it.
But no electric version of Born in the USA. No Cover Me.
My Hometown.
No
Glory Days. He did My Hometown. I think that was basically the only single from that album that he would play on any kind of regular basis.
Note the commonality of all of those. All of those were videos at one time in their lives, the ones he didn't play.
Yes. Well, they were the singles.
But My Hometown, no video, correct?
Yes, there was.
A live video. There was a video.
Live
video.
Boring, but it was a video.
Sort of afterthought.
This is an important thing we touched on earlier. Can we just talk about how awful the videos were from the Born in the USA album? I actually think it really speaks to Bruce's ambivalence and almost resentment. Antipathy to the video form.
I agree.
Where he was someone who wanted people to interpret the songs for themselves.
Right. I think he resented it almost.
It was a push kind of thing. Okay, here's the interpretation of the song, you're going to accept it. And I think he hated it, and the ambivalence really showed in the video.
It's stunning how little thought went into the actual song Born in the USA, the video. I mean, stunning when you look at it. I mean,
and it's also stunning how badly they've aged, too. If you go back and look at them now, I think Glory Days is actually a decent video.
I was going to say that was the only video that I even remember at this
point. Glory Days visually, much like the album, felt effortless. The other videos not only felt effortless, they felt forced and completely faked to the point where, like, they were so fake. You know, like, the fade out of Dancing in the Dark. I mean, it's excruciating to watch.
No, the most excruciating thing is the whole mechanic thing. And the
oh, right.
If I'm on fire. Right. I mean,
I like that.
Porn movie.
Yeah. I love that.
Do you need your oil change?
Dude, I remember even being 14 years old, and I was embarrassed by that. I was like, oh, Jesus.
I think what that's about is record company. You start to see the thumbprint of the record company saying, hey, Bruce, baby, we need the video. Yeah. Come on.
And the best videos Bruce have made have been, you know, single-shot videos like Human Touch and or Tunnel of Love.
And Brilliant Disguise is a brilliant video.
Yeah.
Great video.
Absolutely. But everything else, for the most part, could use some work.
I want
to circle back, though. John, the issue about taking material, and you spoke to it eloquently in terms of pointing out the number of songs that he's gone back and has reconstructed, deconstructed and stuff. And maybe the example of using Dylan is not a fair one because Bruce continually keeps putting out more and more material. Ben and I were talking that it's highly unlikely that we will be forced to suffer through greatest hits tours from him and the band, or even
will never happen.
It'll never happen because I think that he continues to
Bruce.
Yeah. Ooh, Flynn, say it ain't so, babe.
I thought Working on a Dream tour, it was as close to a greatest hits tour as he's ever.
But he didn't pull a Prince tour. You know, like Prince's last big arena tour was a greatest hits tour with the three.
Pretty close.
I don't agree with that.
I don't either.
The tour is an extension of the Magic album, so basically, it really wasn't a. I'm defending Bruce here. I'm trying to go on.
I mean, you know, he just didn't.
Nobody's going.
It's not like
it.
He's ever done something where he's just played the singles, like all the singles in a night. You know what I mean?
That is true. I agree.
He played all older songs and he played very few new songs, but I wouldn't say it was a greatest hits tour.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like a Kiss tour. You know, we're going to play the whole first half of our career all in a row, or you know, that kind of thing.
But you see, Bruce did that. He played the first six albums. on this last tour, and then entirety.
Right, but he didn't take all the singles from those albums and play them all in a row in two hours.
That's true.
So we're going to get some final thoughts on the show and really this whole period of Bruce's career. And I think Flynn McLean from Backstreets is going to take it.
Well, it is the most fascinating period of his career, just in looking how he exploded. But to me, it's
not to mention highly lucrative too.
That too. But to me, the most interesting aspect was the reaction and how it was basically the shadow of the Born USA album and tour on everything he's done ever since. Trying to go personal with Tunnel of Love, to dropping the E Street Band a couple years later, to releasing an acoustic album and going on tour by himself. You know, I think to me, all of that was a reaction to the boom of Born in the USA.
Absolutely agree, yeah.
And I think he has finally made his peace, at least from what he's done, in 99 when he reconvened the band and they went out on the road and, you know, they played a lot of the songs.
And the only thing I would add to that is I think he really emerged from the shadow of Born in the USA with The Rising. I think when Bruce found new songs and a new sound for the band, which he really did with that album and starting to hook up with Brendan O'Brien, that was when I think he was really clear from the legacy of that album. And it took him 15 to 17 years to do it.
Agreed.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So, you know, it's been a great discussion, guys. I really want to thank everyone for being here. Jovan Mervos, Flynn McLean, Stu Wexelbaum, Louis Largent,
yes,
my co-moderator and good friend, John Frank. Thank you so much for being here on the Springsteen Community Conference. And like Bruce says, we'll be seeing you up the road.
Remember me? And you look at him and you kind of remember him, but no remember me like high school. Yeah, we went to high school together. Yeah, remember the guy? The guy in study hall. The guy that dumped a piece of pie on your shirt. Yeah, that's me, that's me. Oh, yeah, yeah, how you doing? But everybody always telling you what a great time you had in high school. Like, then I get all that nostalgia stuff for the 50s and American graffiti and all that stuff. But, like, I remember high school, man. High school was the worst, man. I hated high school. Couldn't stand it. Man, I was bad at my studies. I couldn't do no sports. I didn't know how to, In high school, I was only interested in two things. Now, one was the guitar. And the other one was... Amore. Now, those two, the guitar is the only one I really became good at. That's why the shows are so long, because the other thing happens so fast. I'm still practicing. See, I'm married now, so I get in a lot of practice. Oh, hey, man. Anyway, in the end, it ain't nothing but glory days. Are you ready, big man? All right. Are you ready, people? We see, I had this friend, was a big baseball player. In high school, and man, he could throw that speedball body, making love like a fool, boy. I saw him the other night at this roadside bar. I was walking in, he was walking out. We went back inside, sat down, had a few drinks, but all he kept talking to her. Lives up the block, but back in school, man, she can turn all the boys' heads. Sometimes on a Friday, I'll stop by and have a few drinks with her. After she put her kids to bed, well, her husband Bobby, well, they split up, I guess, must be about 2 years gone by now. Well, we just sit around talking about the old times. She says when she feels like crying, she starts laughing. Glory days, yeah, passing by, glory days. No way to go down, girls, high, glory days, glory days. All right, London, express yourself. Well, tonight I'm gonna drink till I get my fill.
Street Radio's Springsteen Community Conference, focusing on the 25th anniversary of the Born in the USA Tour. Next month, we'll bring a new group of guests to the table to discuss a different Springsteen topic from past, present, and future, exclusively on SiriusXM's E Street Radio.